Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Christy Wilson Cairns, a screenwriter whose credits include Showtime's Penny Dreadful and Edgar Wright's upcoming Last Night in Soho. She's also the co-writer of Sam Mendes' World War I drama 1917, which opens theatrically on Christmas Day. Christy picked Shallow Grave, the 1994 indie that marked the first cinematic collaboration of director Danny Boyle, screenwriter John Hodge, actor Ewan McGregor, and producer Andrew MacDonald, though Christopher Eccleston and Kerry Fox are just as essential to it. McGregor, Eccleston, and Fox play three Edinburgh flatmates who take in a fourth, who promptly dies, leaving them with a corpse and a suitcase full of cash. Naturally, being reasonable people, they decide to dispose of the body and keep the cash, which proves to be the first step on a very slippery moral slope. A perfect noir premise executed with nervous energy and dark humor, Shallow Grave was a sleeper hit that set its creative team on the road to bigger, bolder projects, including Trainspotting, which, come on. But this one was their first, and it'll always be a little special. This is someone else's movie.
So, Shallow Grave is one of my favorite films. I watch it every year, and I think it resonates so much with me. Well, first of all, I'm Scottish, and it was a film set in Scotland, but it didn't have a tartan element. Do you know what I mean? A lot of the times films set in Scotland have to be about being Scottish or whiskey or some battle, whereas this was just an interesting twisted thriller in which the people happened to be Scottish.
Right, yeah.
The other thing that really drew me to it was that the female character in it wasn't a good human being. Like, she was a bad person, and that was pretty rare at the time. It was rare to see female superheroes or female villains. It was rare to have any sort of complex female character, and so I remember watching it and being like, oh, this is something different. It's also twisted and funny and dark and messed up, all the things I hope I am. And so, yeah, so that was how I chose it.
And so I was frankly stunned to realize, looking it up just for a couple of clarification points, it's 25 years old.
And it was crazy that, isn't it? 1994.
I saw it then.
Did you?
Which means I'm very old. Well, it came to Canada a few months later, but it was already building. When it arrived, it was this was sort of peak Tarantino. Pulp Fiction had just hit. Everybody was excited about the new places people were taking thrillers and noir and all of that.
Yeah. It came out, I wouldn't say what age I was, but I was too young to see it in the cinema.
Well, I was going to say.
I saw it in VHS. My grandmother rented it from Global Video, like around the corner from me. And because my grandparents and my mum never believed in the idea that you were too young to watch anything. So I saw Silence of the Lambs when I was like 12, and it permanently scarred me. And I guess a part of this film scarred me as well when I was really young. So the first time I would have seen it, 1994, I'd have been like maybe, say it came out in 95, like 9?
Jeez.
9 or 10 when I saw it. Like too young to watch it. And I remember being absolutely terrified by the ending when he gets stabbed and it goes through the boards.
Yeah.
And I remember also when I saw it again, probably when I was like 14 or 15, when I watched it as if I was watching a film that I wanted to watch rather than a film that I was too young to see. It had like a profound difference. I remembered everything so different. I remembered the horror scenes being way more kind of horrifying.
Sure, your brain fills
in. Yeah, exactly. You fill in all the gaps. I thought it was like a real bloodbath at the end. But actually, the action's just used to further character development.
Yeah,
I love the twist. And I mean, it's one of the smartest thrillers out there, and I think it's sort of always overlooked.
Yeah, I mean, I'm constantly surprised to find it in the Criterion Collection. I own it.
Yeah.
I have the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And yet every now and then I'll be going through the stack and, oh, that's right, that's in there. And the joy of it is that, yeah, it doesn't feel 25 years old.
It's really kind of timeless. I mean, there's a few bits in it like that feel a bit 90s. Like some of the jokes, the giant mobile phones.
Yes.
Like that bit kind of orientates it in time. But the story, the characters, I mean, where it was shot in Edinburgh as well. I'm not from Edinburgh, I'm from Glasgow, but it was a lot of that's really kind of like, it could have been London, it could have been New York. It just had that anonymous city feel.
Yeah, generic urban brownstone feel.
Yeah, just generic kind of like where a lot of people are kind of drawn together and thrown together in close quarters. It also, I mean, what they managed to do, it's a really short movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's the script as well. I read John Hodges' script later, obviously. I've never managed to read the script, the shooting script, which I would always like to have done, but I read one of the scripts that were issued online, so like I kind of retroactively typed after. And it is very austere. It's really to the point, and it's a bit ruthless, and that I think good writing should be like that,
mm-hmm.
and especially when it comes to screenplays. Like, you should be able to paint a visual picture, but never go like mad with, you know, purple prose.
Yeah, it's, well, I mean, the film itself too is a sprint.
Yeah,
right? Just that opening 100%. Shot that moves through the streets, which at that time was still sort of novel. Although I remember, I think The Professional used almost exactly the same approach for its opening credits.
It must have,
Right around the same time. And then there's Killing Zoe on the other side that also starts. But it was just, it was in vogue. And of course, Trainspotting would sort of perfect hurdling activity.
It was funny because I remember reading, I think Danny Boyle's like one of the greatest British film directors. Like, he's just incredible. I love the work he's done, I mean, throughout his career.
Oh, yeah.
But I think I read an article in which he talked about how his father would always say, oh, but it's not Shallow Grave.
Yeah.
And I actually feel the same way. Like, I love Trainspotting. I think it's a great film. But there's something about it, it's just not Shallow Grave. And I would never say that to Danny Boyle. Not in a way that was in any way condemning Trainspotting, but just that I think there's something about that first film that's just really wild and audacious and fun.
Yeah, it's the purity of the execution, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he has nothing to prove and everything to prove.
Yeah.
And Hodges' script is it's merciless.
Oh, it is merciless. The whole film is the score as well. Like, everything sort of, it doesn't feel like a first-time filmmaker at all. Like, it doesn't feel, do you know what I mean? It doesn't feel like someone's debut or anything like that. It feels so accomplished. It feels like the 10th film someone's made in their career because it's so unbelievably streamlined. And the performances in it are fantastic.
I was going to say, and this is the result. Like, I think both the execution of the film and the quality of the performances is the result of him deciding they all needed to be roommates.
Yeah.
As the story goes.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. And I mean, the idea of putting all these people together, it was quite funny. I used to live with two guys, and we are all very good friends still. But we used to feel like we were a bit shallow gravy and everything. Like, because we would occasionally kind of devolve into being like, no, I would 100% murder you,
right.
and then flee to Brazil. Which is just what I think is the sort of usual twisted sort of British flatmate etiquette. There's not so much like, I love you so much, I hope our families grow old together. It's more like,
oh no, I know how I'll kill you.
Help me or I'll murder you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The film that I think of, weirdly enough, for no particular reason at all, except that I connect it in my brain, is Winland and I.
Yes. Oh my God. Uh-huh.
They're bonded and bound by misery and location.
Yes. Yeah.
And here it's simply, it's that exact chemistry and coincidence leading to, no, we will be at war.
Like,
we have this thing which, if we're all responsible and mature, the three of them together collectively have the tools, have the sensibility, have the stamina.
Yeah.
They could do this.
Yes.
But they're human.
Yeah.
And it all goes to hell.
And that's, to me, that's, you know what, that's the absolute crux of it. You've reached the sort of most important point. The reason that I love that film is that they're three flawed human characters.
Mm-hmm.
And the decisions they make, the choices you make, you could see yourself making them. Maybe not so much Christopher Eccleston's, but
he goes the extra mile.
Yeah, Ewan McGregor, like everyone else in it, you can kind of see, you can be like, oh no, there's a version of me in which I do that. And so the humanity, that script, that film drips with humanity. It's so unbelievably kind of like a perfect portrait of what it is to be human. And I think anyone can understand that. If you've ever lived with roommates, you can kind of understand the sort of madness and the small little intimate world that gets kind of wound and wound and wound until someone breaks.
Yeah. Well, the pressures are all completely believable too. I mean, short of the one leap of finding the money, which, again, it's set up. It's that noir thing where you are tempted and what the hell?
Yeah.
It's airtight. Yeah. No one will know.
It feels almost like a kind of Shakespearean drama. You know, it's about greed, which is, anyone can understand. It's so pure and simple. And what they've done is they've spun everything out from that very simple idea. And so the script isn't simple, but the core kind of like human instinct behind it is so easy to understand and access.
Yeah. And you mentioned up at the top that Carrie Fox was surprising to you and that she was just as awful as everyone else.
Yeah, exactly.
But, structurally, we expect her to have the greater morality also because she's a doctor and therefore is supposed to be concerned with these things.
But what I love about, I know a few people that are doctors and they're usually very, very intelligent, and that lends itself to being very rational,
right,
which doesn't always lend itself to being very good. They're quite different things. So that, in a way, everything about that made her character completely believable to me.
Oh, no, she's completely compelling.
And she's incredible in it. Like, what a performance that is. But also, like, the idea of not making the woman the moral compass was pretty revolutionary at the time, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
And actually, it's still weirdly revolutionary now. I mean, one of my favourite shows is Always Sunny in Philadelphia. I read a lot about how, like, when Caitlin Olsen first became involved in it, how she was the kind of like normal foil, and she had to like push back to get so that she could be as mad as them, and that show only works because all of them are terrible people.
Yeah, if there's any grounding, the whole thing falls apart.
Well, exactly. If you have some notion of reality, you couldn't then have that world because it's close to reality, but it's also insane.
Yeah.
And I feel the same with Shallow Grave. Like, if a single one of the people in it, because even the cops, if I remember correctly, are pretty like not good people.
Yeah,
everybody has shades all the way through them, and so like if you had one good pure human being in there, it would fall apart like a house of cards. You pulled the bottom away.
Yeah, the only way it works is if the person who dies at the beginning is a good person.
Yes,
and he's not.
Yeah.
So again,
well, that's
we're
all
off the hook,
that's
right?
The other thing, which I think is a smart choice as a writer and a director, is that you're not taking money from Mother Teresa. Do you know what I mean? It's drug money.
Mm.
No one's going to really miss it. Well,
yeah.
Someone does miss it. But no one, it's not as if you're stealing it out of the mouths of orphans.
Yeah, and it can't be reported. And
it's
safety
it's not recorded.
Is the... You can convince yourself that it's the right choice.
Yeah. And what I like so much, in a simpler version of that movie, the real drama would be the drug dealers coming for their money. But in this version, the real drama is the flatmates, the connection between the three of them, this weird dark triad.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is just infinitely more fascinating.
Yeah. No, it is. And again, the casting is dead on. Eccleston, I had seen in some things. I think he'd already made Let Him Have It by that point.
I think so. My relationship is always so skewed because that's the first thing I saw.
Well,
many
of them. I was
going to
say, if you're nine, this is your discovery.
Yeah, because I remember Ewan McGregor being in Trainspotting, and then obviously in the Star Wars, and so that was like, I thought, oh, he's got really meteoric rise, but there was probably years between all of that for him. It was just compressed for me.
Yeah.
This is the
argument that people make about the Harry Potter movies, which is that kids are seeing the entirety of Mike Lee's cast being magic.
Yeah.
And then they're going to go seek out these things. I had this whole encounter with David Thewlis where he said that the boys who played the Weasley twins were very young. We're just sort of skipping around and saying, oh, sir, we understand you're in... What was it? Oh, Naked, the Mike Lee film. And he would just say, oh, you're too young for that. And then they watched it anyway and say, well, that was very dark. And he just turned to me and said, well, wait until they watch me buggering Leonardo DiCaprio on Total Eclipse.
Could
it's like,
you imagine?
This is what happened. But now, you have Anakin, you have Obi-Wan, you have the Doctor, and Carrie Fox, who somehow never became as big as she should. Did she just go back to Australia?
Like, yeah, maybe. I feel like she never really... I mean, maybe there just wasn't that many roles out there that were interesting enough to kind of appeal to her.
Yeah, I mean, I knew who she was by that point.
Yeah.
And it's a perfect role for her. She have this edge and this hardness that she...
Yeah.
She can turn it on and off, and she does, twice at least, to just beautiful effect in this film.
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, there's like, that scene where they're doing the interviews with the flatmates right in the opening. It's that, just that idea. It sets up the whole tone of the film so well, in the sense that you think, oh, okay, I kind of know where this is going, and I kind of think I know who these people are, and then very quickly the sand shifts underneath you, and you're like... I'm in something completely different, and she is such a skill in that. In a way, it reminds me a lot of Gillian Anderson, that kind of hardness that's very like, she's so beautiful, there's everything, but there's a lot there that draws you in and pushes you back at the same time, like a really, really interesting actress.
Yeah, and when that facade cracks, it's so much more.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that it ever really does in Shallow Grave, because she just gets harder and harder.
Yeah, she does. No, but there's that scene in the car. I think probably my favourite scene is the big confrontation scene, where it's like you know, Christopher Eccleston has her, and she's just like, look, just kind of like, give him what he wants, and we'll all walk out of here, and we'll all be fine. And do you feel real jeopardy in that? And I think, see, because she's built such this hard persona all the way through, you think, oh, the gloves have really come off now. And that's the other thing, is like, traditionally in an action movie, or in the sort of more modern versions of that, there's like someone who's got a gun, and or someone who's so easily going to overpower them. Do you know what I mean? It's like Dwayne The Rock Johnson versus like some little guy. Whereas in that film, it felt more like reality. It felt more like, okay, the two of them could maybe take Christopher Eccleston in a fight, but can they really?
Yeah.
And
are they willing to?
Are they
right?
willing
are they
to?
Like, capable
how far,
of it? Because
exactly,
they're still people.
Yeah.
Not
how far can they push themselves to do it? And I love the scene where she, you know, when she takes the suitcase and she gets in the car, and then when you realise it's all the newspaper.
Yeah.
And her crying and laughing. And she's got no choice but to go and get on the plane.
Yeah. I want to ask Bryan Cranston if he pulled on that for the big moment
at the end of that season
in Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
So that was the first thing I thought of. It's like, well, of course they've seen it. They must have seen
well,
it.
Well, they must have seen it.
Like, I'm sure Vince Gilligan has seen it.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, I don't think enough people have seen Shallow Grave. I mean, I know lots of people have, but I feel like it's not kind of like doesn't remain in the popular culture in the same way. I don't know why.
Probably distribution, right? I think it comes down to something. It was gone for a while before Criterion picked it out. I think it was because, was it one of the Polygram films or Gramercy? There were a bunch of little boutique labels, at least in North America, that just, they sold their catalogs and went away, and half a dozen. Truly great. Miami Blues was gone for a while.
Yeah.
What was the other one that I've always been fighting for? Oh, there's still a Tim Roth movie with Tupac.
What?
Called Gridlock. Yeah. Nope.
I've not seen it.
See? 1998, it was definitely Gramercy or Polygram. And I remember because
Tim
it was...
Tim Roth and Tupac.
Yeah.
Holy crap.
As Hustlers in, I want to say Atlanta, but it might be New York.
Yeah.
And it's tremendous. It's great. It was directed by, oh God, I can't remember now. It was directed by an actor.
Oh.
I will add this at the end because I'm freezing up and we only have so much time. But yeah, no, nobody knows about it. And it's this marvel of tiny, authentic, Vondi Curtis Hall directed it.
Okay.
There we go.
Oh,
Vondi, if you're listening, please get that out again. But that's a film it's 20 years old now, and it's ripe for rediscovery. And I can't believe that the fact that Tupac Shakur probably gave his best performance in this film just hasn't brought it back, but I think it's simply a rights issue.
Wow.
And Shallow Grave, like anything from 1991 to 1997-8 could have been lost forever, and we're just so lucky that these things got pulled back out.
Oh yeah, that's it. And I think as well, like with the, you know, it took ages I think for it to come onto DVD.
Wasn't around yet.
Yeah, well I remember I saw it in VHS the first time.
I had the laser
disc. Well, fancy.
Yeah.
Much fancier than us. And I think I saw it in like 4x3. I know. There wasn't much technical advance in my home in Glasgow at that time. But now I remember watching it in that. And then I think I was in HMV when it was closing down. And I saw a DVD of it. And I was like, oh, yes, finally something to own. But like Netflix should pick it up. Netflix should put it on. Because it's such a... You know, now more and more people are living with their flatmates getting older and older and older because it's, well, nearly impossible
to buy
a home. And I just think the idea is, like, so timeless that, like, what you would do for money. And I was trying to remember the amount of money that it is because it's, like, not that much.
No, it's a couple hundred thousand pounds,
isn't
it?
It's like,
maybe 300,000? It's a weird number.
Which is, like, it's not enough to go and retire, like, do you know what I mean? It's not enough to disappear out of your life for, especially if you're a doctor.
Yeah.
Nowadays you'd be like, no, that's
pay off your student loan.
Yeah. But then what are you going to do? Like, as you find yourself in Brazil, no student loan, great. But like, what are you going to do after that? Like, so there are parts of it that make it incredibly dated, but there are parts of it that are just so kind of open ended. Like, could just be anywhere.
That's how you do it now. I think there's actually potential because Boyle made Trainspotting 2, right? Which is this amazing confrontation with the fact that we get old and we aren't the people who we used to be.
I
would love to see a drama about Carrie Fox's character now. Just
my God,
where is she? Maybe she's not in Brazil, but she's
happy
somewhere.
Happy to write that if you're out there in Danny Boyle.
I'm
sure John Hodges will have first dibs, but like I'm available.
I mean that's actually not an impossible pitch, right? Like that's an interesting, and you don't even have to drop it. You could even release it in a way that is a stealth sequel. Don't let people make the connection themselves.
Yeah. Don't announce Shallow Grave 2.
What would she be doing?
I mean, she'd probably be like doing some sort of backstreet surgery on gangsters in Brazil, wouldn't you?
Yeah, because now she'd imagine she's lived that life.
Yeah.
Right? She arrives with street cred. She's not afraid of blood or knives.
Or maybe she's running a gang. I'd watch that.
I would watch that.
I mean, I would 100% write that.
That's a Netflix series.
Now. Oh, yeah. Like Narcos, but
much,
Narca. Much more bad. Narca. I like that. I like that.
One woman, one gang. I can see it. And maybe McGregor shows up at the very end.
Yeah, you know, just to sell it.
He won, right? He kept the money.
Yeah, he kept the money. Remember, because he stabbed, and then they do that amazing shot where you think he's dead.
Yeah.
They take a picture of him and everything like that, and then he's like, they pull the knife out, and the camera goes through.
Yeah, the to show you the blood dripping onto the money.
The blood dripping onto the money, and him
beautiful
laughing.
Beautiful signature.
That beautiful laugh. And then what's the song that plays at the end? Oh, God, what is it? It's like such a great, like, old-fashioned fuck you song. Oh, sorry, can I
swear? No, absolutely.
Okay, such a great old-fashioned, like, fuck you song. I wish I could remember it. Happy Heart, that's what it is.
Yes, that's right.
It's just, I remember watching that, and it would be maybe like the second time I'd watch it, so not as a terrified child.
I was going to say, this is like, if you're watching this at 9, it's like, this is how adults behave.
Yeah, I was like, oh my God, I'm afraid of money and grown-ups. But just that idea of like that amazing song kicking in and just being like, oh my God. It was like one of the films that made me want to work in film. But the films that made me want to work in film are all pretty weird.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're not kind of like traditional masterpieces.
I hear this a lot, though. It's the ones that push things. It's the ones that show people that you could do this.
Yeah.
You know, not just, here is a film about a very important issue that we're all going to think about.
Of course.
It's the, you can make a movie where all of this, like, this insane pinball machinery is packed together.
Yeah.
And it's alive. And you could do this if you came up with a way in.
Well, yeah.
And then people walk out and go, yeah, I think I could do that. Not that, but something like
that. Yeah. Well, that's it. And I think also some of the, I mean, some of the films that made me want to work in film are actually just bad movies.
Okay.
Like Charlie's Angels 2 Full Throttle made me want to work in movies. And it's not objectively a fantastic film, but I remember watching it and being like, wow, it looked like they really had fun. I really want to be a Charlie's Angel, or I want to work in film. And so, in a way, Shallow Grave did that as well. I was like, wow, this looks amazing. This is, like, transportative. It's like you're understanding what it is to live someone else's life.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I suppose, was just, like, an automatic instinct. Out of greed, I wanted to live many lives. And I thought, well, as a writer, I have the chance to do it by working in film.
Yeah, I mean, it does. I was trying to figure out why there are some movies that feel like parties that invite you in.
Yes.
And this is one of them, because we are allowed to vicariously enjoy everything that happens, including the betrayals, without any damage to ourselves.
Yeah.
Right? But it's a film where you can root for literally anyone.
Yes.
And not be entirely wrong.
Yeah.
And not be, and you can feel a little dirty about it.
Like we said before, there's no good person in there. And because there's no good person in there, then you're allowed as the audience to bring your own stuff to who you root for.
Yeah.
So I remember obviously rooting for Carrie Fox's character because, like, as a young woman, and there was so much I responded to and identified with her. And then, like, as the film progresses and you realise that she's become a terrible human, you jump to Ewan McGregor's character. I mean, I was never for Christopher Eccleston, although I felt profound sympathy and sorrow for him, because I felt like he was just losing his mind. So it is very cleverly tailored to suck you in. Like, everything about it draws you in. Everything about it makes you lean forward in your seat or in your chair.
Mm-hmm. I think the secret is, too, that if everyone's bad, then we get to be the best people.
Well, that's
it. We get
to
sit outside and not judge exactly, but just think, I probably would have figured that out.
There's also something to be said about, like, that cathartic watching people do bad things on screen.
Mm-hmm.
It is incredibly satisfying when someone does something bad exceptionally well. So, like, when after everything bad that's happened to you, McGregor, when you see that money beneath him, drenched in his blood, you do feel like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, he earned it.
Yeah, he earned it. He won.
Yeah.
And, like, ultimately, that's what it is. It's like a kind of, like, evil competition, in that you want to just watch it. And it's satisfying again and again and again. Even though you do know how it ends, it's a movie that actually stands up to rewatching. It's very well done. There's, like, little moments, little giveaways, little character ticks.
Yeah, you get to watch the pieces fit together this time,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. The first time, you're just kind of wowed. The first time for me, I was just kind of terrified.
Oh, yeah.
The second time, I was just kind of wowed. And the third time, I was like, oh, okay, this is a smart film. Like, this is how you construct a character-driven thriller.
Yeah. And so this brings us to the other question of the podcast, which I've been trying to figure out whether there is a direct connection to 1917. I can't see that there is.
I don't think there
other
is.
Other than a ticking clock.
No, do you know what? The connection between, I suppose, 1917 and Shallow Grave, and I don't know if anyone else will agree with this, but I do as the writer, is the importance of character.
Mm-hmm.
As a writer, how important it is to construct characters who the audience root for, regardless of who of their circumstance, regardless of what they're going to do. I mean, you know, in 1917, there's a good chance that, if not Blake, but Schofield has definitely killed people. And that can sometimes make it hard to root for a person that's done it. But the fact that he doesn't want to keep doing it, the fact that he hates being in the war and everything like that, I think is the stuff that you latch onto as the audience. So, like, even though they share very, very little, the onus on writing good characters I picked up from Shallow Grave, and I obviously wanted to make that my own work.
Is there another way that you've sort of lifted or borrowed or outright stolen from Shallow Grave? Something else?
Not really.
Now that
really.
We've pitched the sequel, obviously.
No, well, of course I've pitched the sequel, so that is 100% theft. And I will, of course, my lawyer is and can be contacted at. You'll add that into the podcast,
absolutely,
right?
I want to see the show.
No, not for 1917, but in my other scripts I've been writing, there's always sort of elements of all the films that you love and all the films that have kind of made it into your brain and the ones you watch again and again and again. And in some of the TV shows that I've worked on or that I've pitched, I've always said, you know, oh, it's The Lives of Others Meet Shallow Grave is a pitch I gave literally last week. And so it's there. It's always somewhere under, like, just kind of right underneath the subconscious, working its way out. I'm always trying to make a film that I feel is as good as Shallow Grave.
Right, it's the goal, it's the optimal
Yeah,
form.
Exactly. You're trying to make a film that hopefully 25 years from now you'll be talking to another young writer and they might bring up 1917. I'd be pleased about that.
Yeah. And then I'll say, oh, you should see Shallow Grave.
Yeah, exactly. It's got so much in common.
My thanks to Christy Wilson Cairns, whose new film 1917 opens theatrically on Christmas Day. You can also imagine how hard it was for me not to ask anything about Edgar Wright's Last Night in Soho, coming in 2020. Thanks also to Rebecca Schultz. She knows what she did. You can find Christy on Twitter at WeWriteAtDawn, all one word and an amazing handle, and you can find Shallow Grave on Blu-ray and DVD in the Criterion Collection in a fine special edition that includes a fun retrospective interview with the cast. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. Our new theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it, or this show in general, please say so. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you've been listening to the show. Every little bit helps, it truly does. And check out the other podcasts on the Frequency Network. They're pretty good. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening. We'll be taking next week off, but the show will be back January 7th, and it's a good one. See you then.